From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This week, we'll unpack a very bad year for the NSA.
This year represents the hardest problem that they have ever faced in their 62-year history.
Then we speak to director Ray Fiennes about Charles Dickens' Secret Mistress. And our own man in Texas, Wade Goodwin, chats up a tall, beautiful blonde. I didn't say she was human. To top it all off, a live band comes in the studio to play some Mexican Christmas music. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. It's the time of year for wholesome Christmas fare, and it doesn't get more wholesome than A Christmas Carol. Scrooge getting in the spirit, Tiny Tim saying, "God bless us, everyone." And Charles Dickens, the celebrated author of the story, happily played the part of the proper Victorian gentleman, exactly the sort of moral individual you'd expect to write such a beautiful story. But Dickens had another side.
Tell me a secret.
What kind of secret?
Anything.
That's Ray Fiennes as Dickens, and Felicity Jones as Ellen Ternan, his secret lover.
My middle name is Lawless. Now you're done.
Dickens and Ternan had a 13-year adulterous affair, inspiring the title of the new film, The Invisible Woman.
Ellen Lawless Ternan. That is my secret.
I had a chance to speak with Felicity Jones and Ray Fiennes, who also directs the film.
I think people don't know much about Dickens' life unless they have decided specifically to read a biography. Then, so they have this perception of him as the upstanding sort of Victorian father figure.
Which is extraordinary because it's hard to think of a more public life.
Yeah, I mean, he was extremely successful. He was one of the great sort of celebrities of his day, and he was a sort of forerunner of today's mad cult of celebrity, possibly. But you know, he was ferociously protective of his reputation, and Ellie Ternan was the secret.
Felicity, it must have been difficult approaching your character who has to hold her own alongside this monumental figure. What was that like?
That's why it's such an interesting contrast. He's a man who uses words all the time, obsessed with words, obsessed with understanding the world through literature, through words, and Nelly is very careful when she speaks. You know, she chooses her words carefully, and it was quite a challenge playing a character where so much has to be shown non-verbally.
Rafe, I've heard you say that you're fascinated by the psychology of Dickens. What do you mean?
Well, I get a sense of a man of ferocious energy and a furious imagination, an unstoppable imagination. And at the time we meet him in the story of this film, he's 45 years old, he's a father of 9 children, and he's the height of his fame, and into his life walks this woman. I think in his private life, I think his marriage was frustrating to him. But he's a man of extremes, and we see one other extreme we see in the film is the cruel and possibly brutal way in which he exits his marriage.
She is the mother of your children. How could you be so cruel to her?
And for that, I shall always be grateful. But I do not love her. She comprehends nothing. She sees nothing. I thought if she saw you, then she would understand that I have nothing with her.
He's fallen in love, and so he's in a kind of upside-down turmoil.
There's a wonderful scene. I remember reading about how reading from Charles Dickens was almost like going to a rock concert at that time. And then there's a scene where you recreate one of those readings. How did you approach that?
Well, deciding on what he was going to read. I mean, he didn't read from all of his books. So I chose there's this great storm scene, if you like, towards the end of David Copperfield.
Ham watched the sea, standing alone, until there was a great retiring wave. He seemed to leap up into it with a mighty bound.
And we researched, it's very well documented, that he had behind him red screens. He had a specially designed little table that was the height that was comfortable for him to lean his elbow on. So we absolutely recreated it to its original design. There's a great assembly hall in a school called Harrow, just outside London. And then we just filled it with as many people as we could, and I asked them all to listen rapt, as if they couldn't move a muscle. The reading was so compelling. He read, you know, in a very convincing and magnetic way. And
he desperately wanted to be an actor himself, so any opportunity to be on stage, he just took wholeheartedly.
Well, another aspect of him that I think is not as widely known that really the film digs into is his attraction to the theater.
He wanted to be an actor as a young man, and then there was the day of an audition that he had. He got very ill and sick and never went, and then never decided to try again.
What was the relationship for both of you like with Dickens, the writer, before you approached this project?
I mean, in England, Dickens is so ubiquitous, so, you know, you're surrounded by him from a really young age. But I wasn't a huge fan before. So it was only since being involved in the film that I started to really investigate him and appreciate him, and have since become completely obsessed with Great Expectations, as was Nelly, and really appreciated his incredible writing.
Wilkie thinks I should change the ending.
No, you must not. To bring Estella and Pip together at the end, but not to unite them.
She has changed, that is enough.
Yes, it is a sad ending, but Estella finds her heart, she finds an understanding at last.
Rafe, you direct this film as well, and it's something that ever since I saw my first Woody Allen film, I've wondered how people direct while they're acting, but especially with these physical scenes, that I have a hard time imagining how you're figuring out your camera angles and things like that when you're right there in the film acting your heart out.
In a way, it's hard and it's straightforward. The hardest thing is just the mental adjustment of having had a technical discussion about a camera position that's going to be here and we're standing there and the light's there. Then to go, okay, now I'm going to go and be Dickens.
And Felicity, I know he's in the room right now, but what was that like working with him as a director?
I'm blocking my ears.
I think because Rafe was acting and directing, it actually becomes very collaborative. We spend vast amounts of time discussing the character in depth. I would say Rafe is always extremely honest. He has no desire to kind of overly flatter you if he doesn't feel the need to. So I've trusted him immediately and felt very comfortable.
The two of you played father and daughter in a previous film, right?
Yes.
It's a bit weird.
It's very Freudian. To go from father and daughter to lovers.
It's just a job, come on.
What?
It's just a job.
What have you both taken away from this film in terms of what you think about Charles Dickens?
Oh, wow. I feel very still connected. Sometimes you do a film and you sort of move on from it. I get a sense of an extraordinary man, of amazing imagination and potency with many, many flaws, but it's the sense of a man that never wasted a second of his life. And I find that kind of very inspiring.
I feel like Nelly, I have a bit of a love-hate relationship for Dickens. He was this extraordinary genius, but at the same time, I think he was deeply flawed and could be a very cruel man. So I find my feelings towards him are constantly fluctuating between those two extremes.
Felicity Jones plays Ellen Ternan in the film Invisible Woman, which opens Christmas Day. Rafe Fiennes directed and also plays Charles Dickens. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Turning back to this country and the controversies surrounding the National Security Agency. This week it became clear that President Obama will likely make some changes to how the spy agency does its work. How far those changes go, well, that's an open question. Will they, for example, adjust or even end the bulk collection of phone records? At his press conference yesterday, the president said that is part of the discussion.
It is clear that whatever benefits the configuration of this particular program may have may be outweighed by the concerns that people have on its potential abuse.
The president promised a definitive statement on the NSA in January. Siobhan Gorman covers intelligence and national security for the Wall Street Journal, and she's on the line from Washington. Siobhan, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
So this week, the panel appointed to review the NSA's activities made its report to President Obama. It had 46 recommendations. What would you say are the big takeaways from that report?
Probably the two biggest elements of it are that they recommended that the NSA end the so-called bulk collection of American phone records. In its place, they recommended that the NSA have a system that allows them to search that same data, but held either by the phone companies or a third party. And it would also require a court order in order for NSA to actually conduct an individual search. The second element that I think was probably most important and most striking was the recommendation that NSA afford non-U.S. citizens similar privacy protections that it affords U.S. citizens. And so that, I think, in particular, is aimed to kind of quell the controversy, especially among our allies in Europe.
The president was also asked about the effectiveness of these spy programs, about if they'd actually prevented any attacks. The government has said they have prevented attacks, but how strong is their case?
Well, this week, the case for the effectiveness of these programs took a giant hit, because what you saw earlier in the week was a federal judge for the first time weighing in from the outside, not one who had sat on the secret court, taking a look at the phone records program and saying that he did not think that it had demonstrated much in the way of effectiveness for preventing terrorism. Then you saw toward the end of the week this review panel weighing in with a very similar assessment. And so that's really calling into question the strength of the case for many of these surveillance programs.
And more broadly across the intelligence community, what has been the response?
I think that there's a lot of angsting right now. The leaders of the intelligence agencies, particularly at NSA, have said that they're, you know, open to considering changes. But for example, in the phone program, they do warn, and they have warned several times now, that if, say, this change were made to take the data away from NSA and leave it at the phone companies or a third party, they basically assert that they might miss some important clue. We are also seeing the lawmakers who lead the intelligence committees now trying to come out more strongly in favor of basically the status quo with more transparency. They put out another statement yesterday to that effect.
I think it's safe to say 2013 is going to be a year that NSA will never forget.
That is true. In fact, I was speaking with a top official there who said that basically this year represents the hardest problem that they have ever faced in their 62-year history.
Where do you see them in this next year? How do they move forward from this?
Well, at some level, they're probably going to have to accept some proposals for change. And the question is really whether they can get ahead of it, whether they can rebuild their reputation. And that's a real open question right now.
That's Siobhan Gorman. She's a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, thank you.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Now to the world of pinball. Okay, it's not a very big world. In fact, today there's really only one company that still makes pinball tables. But one man is trying to smash the pinball monopoly. NPR's Francesca Fenzi has the story.
Meet Jack Guarneri. He runs an unusual business.
We have a company that builds pinball machines in New Jersey, and it's called Jersey Jack Pinball.
Jersey Jack is the first pinball manufacturer to emerge in almost 30 years. For the past decade, if you wanted to own one of the tabletop arcade games, you had to buy it from one company, Stern Pinball.
You know, it would be a boring world, I guess, if there was only one company making shoes or handbags or anything. So I think more competition and more product in the marketplace raises the awareness of pinball.
Something else to know about pinball. Between 1955 and 1970, the games made more money than the entire American movie industry. They were big bucks. And 30 years ago, there were nearly a dozen pinball makers in the U.S. Now, there's only Stern. Tim Arnold owns the Pinball Hall of Fame in Las Vegas, and he explains that Jersey Jack's real challenge won't be breaking Stern's monopoly, but squeezing into the market at all.
Back in the day, they used to sell 5,000 to 10,000 of each pinball machine. Now they're lucky if they hit 1,000 to 1,500. So it's exactly like the movies. If you get a hit movie, everything's great. But if you have one or two dud movies in a row, you're in deep trouble financially.
According to Arnold, Jersey Jack needs to do two things to succeed: create an incredible product and bring it to the masses. In other words, Jersey Jack needs a magic slingshot. Or maybe just a wizard.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
The company's debut game, based on the Wizard of Oz movie, certainly qualifies as incredible. Arnold compares it to going from black and white to color TV.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
It has a multicolor LED screen that plays animations and movie clips during the game, plus special flipper settings and lights that transform the board according to each new mission.
If you're going for the Emerald City, all the lights turn green. If you're battling flying monkeys, it all turns red. It's really a spectacular visual presentation.
There's only one problem. The Wizard of Oz is hard to find. Even 2 years after its initial release, you're not likely to see the game in a local arcade. Many of the units have gone to homes of private collectors. Molly Atkinson is one of the few who has played it, and she had to go to a collector's home to do so. That's because she's a collector herself. She runs a public access arcade called Pins and Needles in Los Angeles.
It's a real fancy game, Wizard of Oz. It has a lot of neat features on it, and I don't know, for some reason it's really grown on me.
But Atkinson doubts it will join her collection anytime soon. The machine costs about $8,000. She only charges 25 cents per play. But even if she charged double, it would take 16,000 games for her to recoup that cost.
No new games are affordable. When it was a public play thing, games never cost this much. And then the arcade thing kind of died out. And there was only the one manufacturer remaining. So they were kind of controlling all the costs. And they went up and up and up. So we finally do have someone else who's entered the market. But their games are maybe even more expensive, so it's just very unattainable for someone like me to get one.
Still, Atkinson says the arrival of a new game maker is a good thing. She hopes that competition between the two companies will generate more exciting games and breathe fresh life into the industry. For Jack Guarneri, renewed excitement in pinball is the whole point.
That's really what you want to hear, that's success.
He plans to release Jersey Jack's second game, The Hobbit, this spring, and says that a third machine with an all-original design and story is already in production. Stern didn't respond to press inquiries for this story, but a banner on the company's website declares it the only maker of real pinball games on the planet. Guarneri says they probably just haven't updated the site yet. Francesca Fenzi, NPR News.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
From NPR West, it's All Things Considered. I'm Arun Roth. It's time now for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Each week, he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Arun, great to be here, and early happy holidays to you and to all the listeners.
Great story this week about something that we'll be hearing about for certain in 2014, a rising star in the world of food, an Iranian-American woman who's writing what sounds like the next great cookbook.
So Samin Nosrat, you're going to love her story, Arun, grew up the daughter of Iranian immigrants down in Southern California, always loved food, jokes that her lunchbox used to be very different than the lunchbox of her kind of classic American pals, led her to love cooking. And she decided that instead of a cookbook that just laid out an endless number of recipes, she really wanted to teach people how to use four essential elements, salt and heat and fat and acid, in order to cook whatever they wanted.
Your mind can get blown when you teach people how to use the right amount of salt in their food. Like, holy crap, their life changes.
So you don't need fancy ingredients, she'd say. You just need to know the basic principles involving those four things.
And she had an interesting approach to getting where she is, that she just would go after mentors and not take no for an answer.
You name it. Alice Waters, the famous chef and owner at Chez Panisse, Michael Pollan, the best-selling author and food journalist, and a number of others, she would write these great letters to. And in the case of Alice Waters, beg her for a job, any job, which ended up being vacuuming and sweeping at Chez Panisse. Or in the case of Michael Pollan saying, I want to take your course at UC Berkeley, even though I'm not enrolled there. And so she... By the way, Arun, just a year ago, was only making $17,000 and just recently landed an incredible book deal. She had no less than 12 different publishers bidding for it and ultimately decided to partner with one and is working on that great book.
Carlos, you did an interview this week with a man. I had never heard of this guy before, but he's had a huge effect behind the scenes in the tech world. It sounds like he also kind of likes to stay behind the scenes. He doesn't do many interviews.
This is his first kind of big public interview in over a decade. Bill Campbell is what many of us call the CEO whisperer. About 15 years ago, Arun, he started advising a then little known CEO named Jeff Bezos of Amazon. While Bezos was on the edge of being kicked out of his job as CEO, Bill came in, gave him incredible advice, and gave good advice to the board. And today we see one of the most successful CEOs of all time. He did the same kind of advising for Steve Jobs, and for a whole series of others. While he's not a big public name for many people in the know, one of the most important names in business is Bill Campbell. Bill, by the way, grew up in steel country in Pennsylvania, made his way on scholarship to college, and later became a football coach. He was, believe it or not, the head coach at Columbia University, an Ivy League school. And when you ask him why he no longer is coaching and instead went into business, he said, "Have you looked at my record?" And so he moved into running companies. But Bill often says that how to lead people, not just manage them, but lead and grow people, is an incredibly important skill that people don't always have. And so he often spends a ton of time with people on both how to lead and how to really make sure that the business is running effectively and efficiently.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Aussie. You can explore all the stories we talked about at npr.org/newandnext. Carlos, thanks again.
Hey, my pleasure. Have a terrific holiday.
You too. Not sure if this fits in with the new and the next, but here's an unusual business idea that seems to be working. In Texas, a former zookeeper takes intrepid travelers camping via camel. NPR's Wade Goodwin went with him to a place where camels were once a common sight, the Big Bend region of West Texas.
It's 10 o'clock on a crisp West Texas morning, and a group of five camel trekkers stand under the open sky of the Davis Mountains. A few feet away, guide Doug Baum and Jason Mayfield load up five camels.
Jason, let's take this, and it's going to go on Irene. She's going to end up carrying two of these bags. Or we can leave it. It's only the cook gear, right? We don't need it.
You have to like a man who brings his own camel to a camel trek. On Jason Mayfield's arm is a tall, beautiful blonde.
Her name is Butter. She is 8 years old. I've raised her since she was 24 hours old. I raised her on a bottle. She is truly one of my best friends on this planet. There's nobody that I would rather go hiking with or camping with.
Mayfield says everything Americans think they know about camels is wrong. They aren't mean, they don't spit. It's the camel's cousin, the llamas, who spit. And they're every bit as smart as a horse, if not smarter. Mayfield says he loves his wife and children dearly, but he'd rather be with Butter on trips into the wild.
Butter never complains. Butter's always eager to go. Butter's always happy to see new places, new faces, and that's what makes it exciting for me. About as good as they come.
For thousands of years, camels have carried men and women across the world's deserts. Butter, Irene, Richard, Cinco, and Ibrahim know they're about to go on a camping trip, and they're practically as excited as the guests, talking to each other as the men load them up. The camels kneel down on all fours so that you don't have to board by trampoline. When the camel stands up, it's quite the roller coaster. But then it's like you're riding an 18-wheeler. You can see everything from up here.
As we roll, folks, we go single file. If your camel tries to pass the next camel, slow him down with the reins.
And with that, we're off into the beautiful Chihuahuan desert of the Davis Mountains. At more than a mile above sea level, this is Big Bend country. In the winter, the yucca and prickly pear cactus combined with the gamma grass to paint an endless vista of green and gold. The mountain peaks reach to more than 8,000 feet and hide stands of juniper, oak, and pine. In a crowded world, this is the antidote. The scale out here is so vast, it's diminishing. It's impossible to feel master of the universe in this place. Guide Doug Baum says an indigenous people lived here 9,000 years ago.
If you look at virtually any limestone shelter in the hills or mountains, the discoloration on the ceiling owes its color to the soot from fires.
Later, this became the realm of the Mescalero Apache and the Spanish and the Comanche. And finally, in the 1850s, the first American settlers took root as the nation moved west. And the soldiers that came to guard them discovered that their horses and mules didn't cut it out here. They couldn't traverse the distances between the water supplies. So General Jefferson Davis brought in camels before turning his attention to other things, like secession.
The U.S. actually sent a sailing ship, the USS Supply, twice. And they bought camels in the modern countries of Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, and what's now Turkey.
Eventually, hundreds of camels would be in use in the Big Bend by the army and private owners. What happened to them all? Well, after the Civil War, everything that the Confederate trader Jefferson Davis had advocated for was scrubbed away, and that included the Army's camels. The railroads finished them off. By the 1870s, the camels were mostly gone. That is, until Doug Baum and his Texas Camel Corps brought them back. Michael and Brandy Wilbanks left their three teenage children back in Fort Worth to log some precious time alone together. It was Michael's idea to camel trek. When he first proposed it to Brandy...
What? Are you kidding me? I don't think so. And then it kind of grew on me.
Camel trekking is like backpacking, only without having to carry anything. When you tire of riding, you walk. Got a long climb ahead, get back on your camel. Bird watchers in particular love the freedom it affords them. This is the Wilbanks' first time riding a camel, their first day.
It's been a little scary, but it's good. It's good.
10,000 years ago, a species of prehistoric camel roamed Big Bend. Smaller than the camels of North Africa, they were eventually hunted to extinction by humans and other predators, but a tiny echo of their existence still walks the Trans-Pecos. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
If you've been out buying books for kids this holiday season, you may have noticed bilingual picture books are huge now. Tens of millions of Americans speak a language other than English at home, and many of them are children. And a lot of parents today, regardless of background, want to give their kids a head start on a second language. Monica Brown has written more than a dozen books in both English and Spanish. She says her inspiration comes from her own upbringing.
I was born the daughter of a South American mother and a North American father, so I was raised bilingually, and it wasn't until I had children, my daughters Isabella and Juliana, that I decided to write for children. And I knew I wanted to write stories that reflected the multi-ethnic, bilingual nature of my own family.
And I should make clear that when I say you're writing in English and Spanish for people who haven't seen the books, these are bilingual editions. They're children's books, beautiful children's stories, and you have the text in both English and Spanish right next to it.
Yes, two languages exist side by side on the page, which is a beautiful thing because it allows moments of multiple literacy. So a grandmother whose first language is Spanish or an abuelita whose first language is Spanish can share a moment of communication and delight with a child who is bilingual, and American-born Latinos who are learning Spanish can see two beautiful languages side by side on the page.
Well, that's one of the funny things about the books is that they're actually, they're great for the adults, for the parents and the adults who are reading them, because one of the things is being children's stories, that the text tends to be simpler, and so I find myself learning a bit of Spanish, actually, as I'm doing this, because you can see the words that correspond and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. In fact, I know my books have been used to help teach English language learners here in my own community. I think picture books are especially useful for English language learners because there's multiple cues to understanding. So not only are there the words side by side on the page, but there's also these beautiful images that are interpretive that allow for different types of translation and understanding.
I want to talk about my favorite character. This character, her name is Maricel McDonald. She has freckles and red hair and a funny name. Maybe you could tell us about her maybe by reading the description of her.
Okay. My name is Maricel McDonald, and I don't match. At least, that's what everyone tells me. Me llamo Maricel McDonald y no combino. Al menos eso es lo que me dicen todos. I play soccer with my cousin Tato, and he says, Maricel, your skin is brown like mine, but your hair is the color of carrots. You don't match. Actually, my hair is the color of fire, I say, and kick the ball over Tato's head and into the goal.
She literally has mismatched socks and clothing, and she likes to combine playing pirates along with playing soccer.
Yes, absolutely. And she's a pirate princess soccer-playing artist. So she really doesn't fit people's expectations, and I think it's hard for kids that don't fit into boxes.
And is this something you've heard from a lot of people, like myself, regarding my kids and my family, that a lot of mixed-race kids identify with Marisol?
Well, absolutely. I think in the 2010 census, over 9 million people reported multiple races. And in 2010, 15% of marriages were interracial. So this is the future. And I just did not see those books out there. And frankly, this manuscript, which was written, gosh, almost 9 years ago, got more rejections than any other of the 14 books that I've ever published. I think on the one hand, publishers were worried about potentially offending people, because you can talk about challenging topics with children, but I think it's easier to go with books that depict, you know, television characters or sweet stories. And this is a sweet story, but it's also a different story. And I think people are afraid of what's different sometimes.
You know, you mentioned topics that make people uncomfortable. You've done some marvelous illustrated biographies of important figures. You have one of the soccer star Pelé. One, though, I was noticing, Cesar Chavez. You have to deal with injustice and difficult things, and I imagine that would be something that would be hard to pitch as a kid's book.
It's actually pretty amazing, because if you look at one of the spreads where I write, when Cesar grew up, he and his friends were hurt by dangerous tools and had mean bosses who sprayed the plants with poisons that made the farm workers sick. And those, to have that image in a children's book is important, because it's part of our history.
That's Monica Brown talking about her bilingual books for kids. Her latest book is called Marisol McDonald and the Clash Bash. If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. And I'm joined here in the studio by world music DJ Beto Arcos. He's a frequent guest here on the program, and he's the host of Global Village on KPFK here in Los Angeles. Beto, you have a very special treat for us today. Some weeks back, you suggested we feature some Mexican Christmas music this weekend. This week, it's not just you and me here chatting about CDs. You brought us an entire band here in our cozy little studio. Could you introduce us?
Yes. I'd like to welcome to the studio the group Cambalache. This is an East LA ensemble that play the music from Veracruz called Son Jarocho. This is a traditional roots music from the state of Veracruz in southern Mexico. And please welcome to the studio Cesar Castro, who plays the requinto, also known as the guitarra de son. He's also a vocalist and percussionist. Xochi Flores on the zapateado, the foot tapping that you're going to hear. She plays jarana. She also does vocals. Chuy Sandoval on the jarana. He's also a singer. And Juan Perez on the acoustic bass.
Thank you. Thanks Gracias. For having us.
Great. And what's this first song that we're going to hear?
The first song we're going to hear is called La Rama, which means the tree branch. It's the symbol of the festivity of this music and tradition in Veracruz.
And we have one here in the studio with us.
Yes, we do. Unlike, say, the Christmas trees, which stays at home and you just decorate it and you put your gifts around it, This is a traveling branch. This little tree branch, which could be from any tree, you decorate it with different things and then you walk around it with the group singing along.
And you take it with you.
That's right.
Great. Well, let's hear the song.
Cantando
afuera y verán qué bonito, verán a la rama con sus farolitos.
Zaranjas y lima, limas y limones, batida la virgen que todas las flores.
Ya nos despedimos porque ya nos vamos, y a ustedes señores las gracias les damos.
Naranjas y lima, limas y limones, maldita la virgen que todas las flores.
Ya se va la rama por la oscuridad, y a usted le deseamos feliz Navidad.
Naranjas y lima, limas y limones, maldita la virgen que todas las flores.
Ya se va la rama por todo el sendero, hasta el año entrante, hasta el venidero.
That's the band Cambalache with the Mexican Christmas song, La Rama, which is the branch, right?
That's right. The song says something about this coming of baby Jesus. And then also, it's a group of musicians and people that are asking for a little gift from you as the person that is listening to this music, either in the street or in a market or in somebody's house.
Well, it was beautiful, all of you. Thank you for sharing that with us. What can you tell us about the next song?
The next tune is called El Canelo. This is a song that I thought would be perfect for this occasion because it talks about food. This is the time of the year when we love to eat a lot of different foods, but this one, and drink as mm-hmm. well. But this song is sort of a warning, like, watch out, because if you overdrink or overeat, something might happen. Let's take a listen to El Canelo with Cambalache.
¿Dónde vas, Canelo? Con ese gran paso. Voy a una posada a comer pambazo. Voy a una posada a comer pambazo. A la tripi tripi, a la tripi troles. A la tripi tripi, a la tripi troles. Cuidado, Canelo, no te descontroles. Porque el pan traiciona y más con los frijoles. ¡Uy! ¿Dónde vas, Canelo? Ya comiste lonche. ¿Dónde vas, Canelo? Ya comiste lonche. Voy con mi compadre a tomarme un ponche. Voy con mi compadre a tomarme un ponche. A la tripi tripi, a la tripi trete. A la tripi tripi, a la tripi trete. Cuidado, Canelo, con lo que prometes. Llévala tranquilo, no le eches piquete. ¿Dónde vas, Canelo? Tú siempre te sales. ¿Dónde vas, Canelo? Que tú siempre te sales. Ay, ahorita vengo, voy por los tamales. Ay, ahorita vengo, voy por los tamales. A tripi tripi, a la tripi trote. A la tripi tripi, a la tripi trote. Ricos los de masa, buenos los de lote. Pero lo que pasa es que te crece mucho el bote. Canelo, hola, soy la muerte. ¿Dónde vas, Canelo? Hola, soy la muerte. Ay, Canelo mío, has tenido suerte.
encuentro te vas a salvar, porque yo estoy flaca y no te puedo cargar. Ahí quédate en tu posada y ponte a bailar.
That is the LA-based band Cambalache. They're playing El Canelo. With me is world music DJ Beto Arcos. And I want to ask all of you in the band, I don't recognize all the instruments specifically. Are these specific to Veracruz?
Yes, they are.
Yeah? And say your name again for us.
Cesar Castro.
Cesar Castro.
From Veracruz. They are the jaranas. They come different size. Those are the strumming instruments. And then the melodic one that I'm playing, mm-hmm. called requinto, also comes in different sizes.
Okay.
And we also have violin, harp, other instruments, and some percussion that we're going to perform.
Well, I think we're gonna hear that in the next tune. Could you talk about this percussion? What have you got here?
The tarima down here is a wooden box where you dance on top of.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main percussion in our culture. And then we have the tambourine and the donkey jaw.
Donkey jaw. Jawbone from a donkey, that is it hollowed out, or how are you making the sound on the jawbone of the
after the animal dies?
Uh-huh.
You dry it, and you let the ants do the work. Earth warms.
Could you play a little bit just in the so we can hear
definitely.
That? This is
so
the donkey jaw.
This is the
widow
part and the teeth, and the most interesting sound now.
So you're strumming the stick across the teeth, and then you kind of whack the jaw with your wrist to get that vibrate-y sound.
And the fork shape that it has, that's what creates the vibration.
Like a very low tuning fork.
Yes.
Nice. And Beto, can you tell us about this last song we're going to hear?
The last tune is one of my favorite tunes of this musical style. The lyrics go back to the late 1700s. This is a song that has to do with the Inquisition in Mexico. This song was actually censored. It was prohibited by the Holy Inquisition because it denounced the sexual abuses of the clergy at that time.
Wow.
And at the same time, it uses double entendre, and the music, you'll see, it's very sensual, very beautifully danced as well. It's very special tune. It's called El Chuchumbe.
That's Beto Arcos. He hosts the world music show Global Village on KPFK here in Los Angeles. We've been joined by the LA band Cambalache. Everyone, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Feliz Navidad.
Igualmente.
Okay, let's hear that song.
Señores, el chuchumbe.
Señores, ¿qué es este son? Señores, el chuchumbe.
Bonita su entonación, bonito se oye y se ve.
Bonita su entonación, bonito se oye y se ve.
Te vaya bien o te vaya mal, el chuchumbe te va a alcanzar. Te vaya bien o te vaya mal.
And if you want to keep this festive spirit going or share it with your friends, check out our website. All these songs will be up on nprmusic.org. For the week ending December 22nd, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leah Delagula and Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening, and Merry Christmas.